Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
USDA's Economic Research Service has a mission to anticipate trends and emerging issues that impact the economics of food, agriculture, environment, and rural America.
The administrator of USDA's Economic Research Service, Spiro Stefano, on the mission.
And our job is to inform policymakers, try to provide objective economic analysis. We are also one of the 13 principal federal statistical agencies, along with the Bureau of Census, Bureau of Labor Statistics, Bureau of Economic Analysis. And this is a pretty high bar for us to clear. Our job is to provide objective, trusted statistics. We want to acquire quality data. Quality data lead to good statistics, which can lead to good policy.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Given where we are today in 2024, what is different than when I was on that side of the dais and in 2003 we did the Medicare Modernization Act?
Former Tennessee Senator Bill Frist at a House Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing on a healthy America.
We are in such a better position today in terms of the science itself, of whether it's understanding addiction based all the way from opioid disorder back to sugar today, in terms of the science itself, in terms of what works and what doesn't work. In 2003, which was the last big modernization of Medicare, we invented Medicare Advantage to manage patients better. And it's had its ups and downs, and I'm sure here people are, some are for it and against it and all. But the whole idea of being able for a group of the population to help manage, let them make their choices, making the healthy choice the easy choice, requires data. It requires information. We have underinvested in this country in NIH funding for prevention and specifically for food. Only 5% of the NIH budget goes to nutrition prevention, yet we are saying uniformly that it is a root cause of this burden of disease that we have to deal with today. In 2003, we had value-based care introduced. Our outcomes were readmissions to a hospital, death. These really, that's all the endpoints that we have. Now with the science, we have a number of endpoints to apply. We have social determinants of health. We have the importance of food, of transportation, of access, of prevention itself. That's number one. Number two, we have Medicare Advantage, about half the Medicare population, and then we have the non-Medicare Advantage fee for service. I think the committee can continue to make it more uniform in terms of what is expected in terms of nutrition. Social determinants of health, there are four or five that are now recognized in 2024 today. The social determinants themselves that are required in hospitals, that could be expanded to the outpatient arena, not just for Medicare Advantage, but also for the non-medical determinants. And then lastly, I think conceptually, we need to follow the patient in Medicare as we look at Medicare policy, and not the plan, and not just the traditional outcomes, but follow the patient over time. And that takes data. Good science up front, we've underinvested in the past, and then applying that science in an evidence-based way in real time going forward. With that, it becomes a true public health, both crisis, but a public health problem. Not just addressing the endpoints of admissions, what happens in the hospital, whether or not you die of a heart attack, but actually what you're eating and the impact it's having in the preventive aspects of moving forward.
Not just former senator, but Dr. Bill Frist. Dr. Ann Peters is with the University of Southern California on telemedicine in rural areas.
It's made a tremendous difference because in diabetes, we now have the wearable continuous glucose monitors, and those transmit the data to the cloud. So I actually don't have to have you in front of me. I can just look at your data and make decisions. And so we've been doing programs in our clinic where we just give everybody continuous monitors. And I can really improve outcomes, and that's both synchronous and asynchronous telemedicine. And we have a tracking system, we have remote monitoring, we check patients every day, and it really has helped enormously in my ability to reach those patients. Not everybody, however, in our clinic has access to the ability to do telemedicine. So we all worked all the way through the pandemic in person, but the people who can access telemedicine, it's tremendously beneficial. And I would be so sad to see it go away.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For the purposes of this conversation, we're talking about animal disease traceability. We're talking about the ability of our supply chain to, in the event of an animal disease outbreak, quickly trace that disease outbreak back to its source.
Ethan Lane is Vice President, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association on traceability in the industry.
Oh, yeah. This is something that our industry has been talking about for decades now. And, you know, in the last few years, NCBA has had a working group that has spent countless hours with producers from coast to coast talking about just what we want as an industry out of an animal disease traceability system. How many points of data does a system like this need to have to be effective? And how many is too much, right? How much is too much data to have in a system where we start worrying about data privacy, we start worrying about people being able to do something different with that information other than the intended purpose? What does the technology need to look like? Is it high frequency that's more effective? Is it low frequency? Does this need to be a government system or can it be a private industry solution? Do we feel more comfortable with private industry controlling that, with the cattle industry controlling that rather than, say, USDA or state veterinarians? Those are the questions that our industry has been wrestling with for quite some time. In the midst of that, the federal government, USDA APHIS, has begun this rulemaking and now finalized a rulemaking updating their sort of original foray here back in 2013. That is when they established the animal disease traceability rule that we are currently operating under, which establishes a class of cattle, which is intact breeding animals over 18 months moving interstate, as well as rodeo cattle, bison, and dairy cattle, that are required to be traceable as they move from state to state. That isn't steers going to slaughter. That isn't animals under 18 months. That isn't total herd. That is just this one specific group of cattle that's subject to this animal disease traceability rule. It has been since 2013. So the data that we're talking about here isn't new. What's new in this rule is updating the technology in the ear tag that producers will use if they're in that class of cattle to comply with the rule. So up until now, we've seen producers use those metal bright tags, Bangs vaccination tags to comply with this rule. Moving forward after November 5th, they will be required in those circumstances for that to be what USDA is describing as a visually and electronically readable tag. So that's an 840 tag as far as currently approved technology. That gives the users in the supply chain the ability to either use a wand or use readers to get the information from that animal off that tag, or to still do it the old-fashioned way, look at that ear tag and get the numbers off of it and write them down like they always have. Both of those will be possible after this technology update on November 5th, and that data will reside with those state veterinarians, with your tagging veterinarian. What this is not, and I think this is something that's important for producers to understand because there's been a lot of misinformation out there. This is not a big ominous database at USDA where they're going to be able to, ascertain the size of your herd or start to gauge emissions footprints from your operation. This is simply an update to the technology and the existing animal disease traceability program that's going to allow that information to be put on spreadsheets and put into that state database quicker. But it's not any new information really in this process.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Agriculture and rural communities deserve this kind of substantive policy discussion, which is so often lacking in our current political environment.
It's Rod Snyder, former senior ag advisor at EPA at a recent Farm Foundation forum.
I'm here today in my personal capacity, although I am a recent alum of the Biden-Harris administration, and my career spans more than two decades working in agriculture policy. Perhaps most importantly, I am from a small town called Shenandoah Junction, West Virginia, population 700. My family has farmed in Jefferson County, West Virginia, in various capacities since the late 1700s. The future of America's small towns, rural communities, and farming families is deeply personal to me, and I intend to spend my entire career fighting for the vitality of these kinds of places.
Kip Tom is a former ambassador in the Trump administration.
Thank you for the Farm Foundation for taking the leadership to establish this event bringing in people across the ag and food spectrum to have a dialogue, have a discussion here today, and hopefully afterwards as well. But it's the farmers, it's the ranchers, it's the policymakers, it's those that reside in Congress, and those involved all throughout the supply chain, which makes this dialogue so much more important. You know, we've gotten away from this, but I remember when President Eisenhower made a comment, farming looks mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from the field. And I think when you look at agriculture today and we look at our policymakers, I think we see so much policy in Washington that's enacted that is far from what we need in rural America, far from what we need to make sure that we're a reliable source of a strong economy and an agricultural ecosystem.
He does say, based upon prior results, that Trump was actually pro-trade.
Well, I'll start out by saying I have no formal platform from the Trump campaign for 2024 on agriculture, but I can talk about his record in the past and the successes he had. An example would be trade. You know, we know we had some trade wars with China. Soon afterwards, we had the 301 tariffs, which are still in place today under the Biden-Harris administration. We know that soon after phase one was installed with the Chinese, we saw nearly a $26 to $38 billion increase in trade, and we signed an $80 billion trade deal with China at the same time. And we've done over 50 trade deals with China during the Trump administration. I think Donald Trump is clearly the leader in making sure that we have a strong ag economy and making sure we can continue to export our excess here in this country.
Whoever's in the White House will affect policy. David Rauser is chairman of a House subcommittee on water resources and environment.
For more than half a century, the Clean Water Act has worked to improve the quality of our nation's waterways. In our continued pursuit to protect and improve the quality of our nation's waters, it is imperative that the regulatory framework under the Clean Water Act works as Congress intended it to work, allowing the demands of the 21st century to be met. To do so, we must have environmental protection and economic development. This critical balance that protects the environment without unnecessarily hampering our economy and private property rights. To achieve this, we must also balance the role of the federal government with that of the states and municipalities. The Clean Water Act was never envisioned for the federal government to have control over every ditch and mud puddle. It left room for states to protect their waters as they best see fit.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Addictive substances are things that man makes by taking often a plant or a fruit and processing it and altering it so it rapidly delivers a reinforcing agent into the brain and into the body.
At a recent Ways and Means subcommittee hearing on A Healthy America, Dr. Ashley Gerhardt, University of Michigan.
We haven't really evolved to care whether we're getting enough nicotine or getting enough ethanol, but we come out of the womb liking sugar, needing fat, needing enough calories. And so now our food science technology has advanced so rapidly that they're able to make very cheap, irresistible foods that amplify the rewarding nature in the brain. And we just have really never evolved to be protected from that. And when we look at a food supply where this is the dominant source of calories in most groceries, that when people see the brands or smell the smells of the Cinnabon in the airport, it triggers such an intense desire in the brain that even if you see the salad or the very sad-looking apple at the airport, it's hard to make that choice, even if you might know it's healthy for you. And so I totally agree that we want to make the healthy choice the easy choice. And we also need to help people not be so aggressively targeted and tempted by these ultra-processed products that are designed to maximize craveability, hit your bliss point, and make you want more and more and more.
North Carolina Representative and Dr. Greg Murphy says food is medicine.
Thank you guys for coming. You know, sitting here looking up what ultra-processed foods were, the staff in this place is going to go crazy when we get rid of the energy drinks because that's the number one that they put on. And then I saw vegan meat. How about that? How about that, guys? That's going to toss back. But thank you, guys. I think there is full recognition on this committee that medicine or food is medicine. The real question is, how do we get, and, you know, when I tell a patient, I still see patients to stop smoking, to do this, do that. And if you write a prescription, they're going to go to the drugstore and fill it. But the next time they go to the grocery store, they may think in their mind, but are they going to do something different? And so there is a point of coercion where you have to have some of these foods. I look back, you know, when I grew up in junior high school and high school, you didn't have soft drink things in the gym or in the cafeteria. You didn't have any of that stat. You got water or milk, or sometimes you got that, you know, purple juice or whatever that you had. But it is a change. We've also taken exercise out of our schools. The presidential exercise program, fitness program has gone away. So this combination with food, because exercise is healthy also. So I want to pare down on one of our more really at-risk communities, and those are folks on Medicaid and on SNAP. I sadly enough see a lot of end-stage renal patients, a lot of folks who have faced diabetes, a lot of folks who hypertension, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have anything really in SNAP that says you have to eat nutritious food. And if I'm in the grocery store and I'm looking behind and I'm looking, you know, God forbid I just try to hide my potato chips. I've done better. I promise you I've done better. But it's time that we actually did that, because those are at a higher risk population. Those are the ones who end up costing the system more. Those are the ones whose longevity is decreased. So what do we do with SNAP? How do we fix this? How do we then say, look, this is for nutritious food. It's not for soda. It's not for chips. It's not for cookies, in a way that still gives people choice. Because remember, at the end of the day, it is personal choice. You can't force them to take a medicine. You can't force them to eat a food, especially stewed broccoli.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Anytime you have more supply, it's going to have a effect. The question is, will it be a dramatic effect?
On the topic of foreign ag imports, Dr. Joe Outlaw, co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
And then the other question is that are those other countries that are selling to here, what is their weather situation? Do they have ready supplies to keep filling in our market? If they do, then it could have a minor impact on it. But unless something really drastically changes, we don't see that the imports are that impactful today.
Also says when it comes to good farm policy, it actually benefits livestock producers.
Most of the time, the cattle producers will sit in the back and say that this policy doesn't affect us. But the reality is our policies are designed to try to keep the row crop producers in business when things go bad. And that, in its by its very nature, keeps more people around than would otherwise be, which keeps the prices of the feeds lower. So our policies have indirectly subsidized beef production all our lives. But most people don't really think about it that way. So helping our producers stay in business is going to help keep prices lower.
But then there's actual policy. Mike Bost is a representative from Illinois, member of the House Ag Committee with Vincent Messerly.
Based on your testimony and what I'm hearing from my constituents, I think we can both agree that the permitting process here is a mess. It's costly, it's slow, it's killing infrastructure projects. Thousands of small projects die before the builders even have the chance to apply for their permit. And a simple nationwide permit to impact just 0.5 acre of wetland can easily cost upwards of hundreds of thousands of dollars. You've shared that at your nonprofit, we work with over 1,500 permit applicants developing infrastructure projects. Can you share with us real-world examples where WOTUS permitting has significantly delayed or even caused a permitting applicant to just walk away?
Messerly is president of the Stream and Wetlands Foundation.
Good question. I don't have clearance from particular permit applicants to share any names or anything, but it happens quite often. Usually it's small business owners that call, and they just never even bother to apply after they talk with me and find out what the cost is. But there are times where it's even large companies that want to develop projects. You know, one project stands out in my mind, Northeast Ohio, the applicant wanted to impact wetlands to build a large commercial operation. Their siting criteria needed it to be near an interstate highway, needed to be, you know, within a certain distance of the public. They wanted to site it in an urban area for traffic, you know, for business. In that particular project, it was determined that this, I would say, moderate quality wetland that was surrounded by a railroad, industrial park, and an urban arterial highway was too good. It was determined to be regionally important and therefore could not be impacted. The applicant withdrew the permit, built the project about 100 miles away, different city, different community. The community lost out on the job creation.
I think what we're seeing here today, and I know my time is up, Mr. Chairman, but what we're seeing here today is what we've known for a long time about our WOTUS rule. It is ridiculous not being able to know where the government lies and what in the world they can do to you and when they can do it. And that's a shame because it stifles growth and scares many of our landowners.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I started at a very young age on the phone, talking to some people who wound up being titans in the industries.
We think of growing up in ag as being in a field. Louis Barbera, partner with VLM Commodities.
I was fortunate enough, one of my first experiences in cotton was with the ING trading desk that is no longer in business, but one of the merchants that I got a chance to talk to were the fine people at Donovan Commodities, and they really taught me everything I know. Just watching Mr. Donovan trade for all those years and his people that worked for him, Don McHugh, Cores Arthur, a whole host of people, just getting to talk to them and then showing me the right way. And for some reason or another, the Southern hospitality, it's real. They took me under their wing, a poor kid from Brooklyn, and they treated me like family. They invited me into their homes. I've spent Christmas with them. I've gone to the parties. They really have taken me in. And over the many years, it's been a privilege to be in the cotton industry. As far as the West Texas trip, I have some dear friends in Lubbock that I've known for the better part of 25 years. And I've been going down to visit them for the last 15. About a decade ago, they asked me to teach in the Texas International Cotton School, doing the futures and options hedging portion of it. And it's been a real good time meeting up with all the students and giving them a chance to see a side of the business that probably they won't be able to. We also take some of our clients down there, some large hedge funds and some other large traders that also help out in the class, and they get a chance to interact with them. As far as the West Texas trip, we spend a couple of days just doing it as it should be done, going in the car, getting out at each field, having some chats with the growers themselves, and just really getting in there with the crop. Some of my friends in North Carolina will say the most important thing you can put in your field is your shadow, and that's true. There's a lot that you could see from the windshield, but there's a lot that you'll never see unless you get in the field, and that's what we kind of do. We start out all the way north of Amarillo and work all the way down to Seminole. And we do that over a week, and we cover a lot of ground.
What challenges are they facing right now?
Speaking on the crop itself, the further north you went, it seemed to be much better, but you'd get to a line, Plainview South, where it just, the bowls just weren't as big, and you could see how the weather took its toll. It never ceases to amaze me how 20 days in August could cause a million bale swing on a Texas crop. And I mean, and that's the truth. And you from being from down there can attest to it. It just can change so rapidly. And that's exactly what happened. As far as the challenges, I'm not going to tell you anything you don't know about the water. Even people with water don't really have the pressure to keep up with the heat. There's just, you can't irrigate away 105 degree heat for days on end. You just can't. And then at night when the temperature doesn't drop down into, you know, the low 70s, high 60s, the plant's never really shutting down, so it's expelling all that energy. People will give the USDA a lot of crap for their numbers that they put out. They're not as far off as people might think on their initial assessment. This last one down to 14.1, 14.5, I don't know. That seems to be a stretch, but we don't know what the adjusters are going to do. They may be favorable. I hope they are, because it would really stink for some of our friends in the dry land to have to, you know, pick 150 pounds, 200 pound cotton. At these prices, that's a career ender for a lot of people. So I'm hoping and praying that some of our friends get some favorable adjusters who understand the gravity of the situation.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This season for corn growers has been full of surprises. The crop is looking to be bigger than expected, second biggest ever. On top of that, we are seeing
pretty strong exports.
In fact, USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski told us
the fourth quarter corn export pace for this marketing year that's just finishing up right now is on track to be the largest export volume in 6 years.
Led by sales to Mexico.
Some counter-seasonal demand there where kind of offsetting a relatively slow pace coming out of Brazil. So good sales.
Stimulated by not-so-good corn prices, at least not so good for corn growers. USDA is projecting season average prices for corn this crop coming up at $4.10 a bushel, down 55 cents from this past season. Gary Crawford, Washington.